Hello, I'm Father Steve Spahn, and this is Provoke. Today we bring you a story of personal journey and ultimate destiny. It begins with one woman's simple quest to discover the humanity of those we call saints. As the story unfolds, you'll meet a group of dedicated and adventurous nuns who traveled as missionaries to a country more than 1,000 miles and 100 years away from their own, to a culture and a people with whom they fell in love. It ends with the tragic murder of one of them, a modern-day martyr, killed defending the people and place she too had come to know and love so much. How these separate journeys intersect is part of the story. Our producer, Claire Hartman, set things in motion.
As a child, I used to read the lives of the saints the way other kids would read Nancy Drew mysteries or Superman comic books. I was so enthralled by these legendary heroes and heroines, I actually prayed I would one day be a martyr. When the rather gruesome reality of such a violent end registered, I simply deleted that prayer from my daily routine, hoping God would be too busy to notice. And thus, at the tender age of 8, I came face to face with my own human frailty, utter lack of conviction, and a concept known as backpedaling. By 9, I had pretty much given up the idea of joining the ranks of the saints by any method, martyrdom or otherwise, which, as it turned out, had been considered a bit of an overreach by, well, just about everybody who actually knew me. Nevertheless, I remained captivated by the lives of these holy people. To a child, their stories read like fairy tales, full of miracles and magic and unwavering courage. I often wonder, though, if we've done our saints and ourselves a great disservice by portraying them this way. By making them monumentally larger than life, heroic beyond all human recognition, don't we also make them inimitable? As an adult, I'm much more curious about the lived experience of those we call saints than the legend, more fascinated by the raw humanity than the mythology, much more interested in examining them up close to see just what made them tick than putting them on a pedestal where I can only worship from afar. Personally, I think we'd all be better served if, instead of turning the saints into good luck charms with halos, we turned to them as role models whose example we might actually be able to emulate. I mean, wouldn't it be great if we could learn about a saint and think, I know that person. I work with somebody like that. So, what does it really take to be a saint? Not in the canonical, procedural sense, but in the day-to-day, one foot in front of the other, go the distance way. I remember reading about Sister Dorothy Stang, a nun who traveled to Brazil as a missionary back in the 1960s, and by anyone's definition, died a martyr's death in the Amazon some 40 years later. It seemed like a good place to start. My quest to learn more about Sister Dorothy Dot Stang, what made her tick and what gave her the courage to do what she did, took me from Baltimore to Cincinnati to the Amazon and back again. Every day is a winding road. Along the way, I interviewed various members of Dorothy's community, an order of nuns called Notre Dame du Namur. Now, if you're going to accompany me on this journey, the first excess baggage you need to get rid of is your old-school cliché image of a nun. These are not nuns in the long black habits and veils of yesteryear. These nuns wear shorts and t-shirts and baseball caps. They slog around in the Amazonian mud and sleep in hammocks under mosquito nets. Some of them ride motorcycles. They are called by names as casual as their attire: Becky, Bobby, Jane, Joe, Joan, and Katie. If you were going to film the story of their lives, you'd cast Kathy Bates, Meryl Streep, and Frances McDormand, only with short hair and no makeup. They are all cheerful and good-natured women, unpretentious and no-nonsense, passionate and strong as nails. I sat down with them one at a time and listened as each told me a love story about their adopted country of Brazil, its people, and a fellow nun named Dorothy who gave her life for both.
Dorothy had part of her mother and part of her father in her. Dorothy's father, Henry, was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, also German. So if you put the military and the German together, Dorothy's father was very strict. Dorothy's mother was Irish, and she was always in for a lot of fun. And so Dorothy had the stubbornness of her father and the humor of her mother. She was the fourth of nine, and she was the one that had to take care of the younger members of the family, and she told them what to do.
Perhaps no one knew Dorothy Stang as well as her lifelong friend, Sister Joan Krim. They grew up together in Ohio, went to the same schools, entered the convent one after the other, ended up in Brazil together, and grew old together.
They owned a house in Dayton that had a couple acres on it, and the father loved the land, and so they grew most of their vegetables, and they had to take their turns working in the garden. And she learned from her dad to love the land and to care for it. And he taught them sustainable farming. They wouldn't have called it that then. But you never do anything to the earth that will ruin it. From her mother's side, she got her tenderness for those less fortunate. She did a lot of charity work when she was in high school even. She was ornery, always out for a good time. The one picture of her with her uniform on and she has her sleeves rolled up, we were not allowed to do that. And yet she would roll them up every day. And she'd be told to put them back down and back up they'd go. The catalpa tree has little things that grow on them that look like cigars. And she used to pick those off. And during the lunch period, we would sneak behind the boiler downstairs and we would smoke these things just to prove that we could smoke a cigar. That's the way she was. She always had her way. I used to say to her once in a while, "Dot, you know, be real." And she'd look at me and grin and say, "Sure." You know, Dot's sister says, "She's no saint. She may be a martyr, but she's no saint."
What struck me as I interviewed each one of the nuns who knew and loved Dorothy was how they slipped in and out of the present tense when they spoke of her, as if she were at one and the same time gone, but still with them. It seemed cruel to point it out to them. I didn't want to break the communion they still felt. Sister Rebecca, Becky Spires.
Dorothy, to me, is first and foremost friend and mentor. She left for Brazil the night before I made my final vows. And 4 years later, I came myself, and I lived in community with Dorothy, and we did everything together. And I learned how to be a missionary, walking with Dorothy.
Oh, yeah. The other excess baggage you need to get rid of is your 16th century conquer and proclaim idea of what it means to be a missionary. As the story unfolds, revealing more about Brazil and the church in the 1960s, you'll discover these missionaries had a different approach altogether.
I feel most everything I do right, I learned doing it with Dorothy. And she was this really great teacher in the sense that she was not a preaching teacher.
Translation? Dorothy didn't get bogged down doing things for you. Basically, she just threw you in the deep end and then encouraged you to swim, like when they would work in the small Brazilian communities together.
She just said, "I'm busy with the women, so you just take the kids and do something." I said, "Well, how do I do it?" And she just said, "Well, now you just go and do it, honey, you know."
Apparently it worked. Nearly 40 years later, Becky is still in Brazil, working with indigenous Indians and heading up a project to help them preserve their dying culture.
So first and foremost, you know, she's a friend and a teacher and a mentor and a model, and I love her. Dorothy is fun. She's a party. She can make a party out of any situation. When we lived in Coroatá, it was Kool-Aid and popcorn. It was a really big party, you know. But she makes the party because she'll beat a tambourine and she'll dance, and her dancing is, there are no set steps. She doesn't obey any rules. She just moves and enjoys it. And her enjoying of it is what makes it fun. So she's someone everybody likes to have around. That's, you know, on the lighter side. She was, yes, very extremely determined woman. When she had something to do, she did it. And I mean, just nothing got in her way. I mean, it could get in her way, but she'd walk right over it, around it, through it. that when she had to get something done, and she could be extremely irritating with that persistence, just not letting go. And she wasn't the type, though, that is annoying because she holds on to, little stuff. It was important issues. But sometimes it could be irritating because it was like, can you just let up for a minute, But she didn't and wouldn't. There's a moment for a strategic withdrawal, but not for Dorothy. Withdrawal is not in her vocabulary,
This was beginning to sound eerily familiar, the idea that one's strength could also be one's weakness. Dorothy was a doer. She got things done. She sprang into action. That was a good thing. But she didn't have the temperament or patience to wait for those around her to catch up. On more than one occasion, it was downright death-defying. Sister Jane Dwyer told a story about Dorothy and the new bridge to San Rafael's in the Amazon.
It's where we have our training center, St. Rafael's. And we always got there by a canoe. All the bricks, everything that we used, the tiles that we used to cover the roof, everything went over in a canoe. And then at the other side of the river, we had to carry it up on our backs to get it to the place where it was going to be built. And so we spent years doing that.
In 2004, some of the locals finally built a bridge across that part of the river.
These three boys, young men, developed this cable bridge that you walk across. It's safe, but it swings. And so they had just put the slats across the bridge to make it, but they hadn't gotten it, the slats nailed down. They were just loose. And they looked up, and there's Dorothy walking across the slats. They're all loose. Any one of them could have gone and she would have fallen through the water. They almost died till she got to the other end. That's Dorothy.
A picture of Dorothy as someone who could throw caution to the wind, often getting ahead of herself and everyone else in thought and deed, was beginning to develop. Becky Spires.
Dot is fast. She's fast at reasoning, and she prepares. When we would have team meetings, she would always come prepared. And often the guys on the team didn't come prepared. Everybody else comes and sits down and is going to start at the beginning of the meeting. But Dorothy's already read up on it, thought about it, figured it out. So she comes with a plan already. And what this said to them was that she wasn't listening to them. She came in and imposed. And I remember arguing this various times with different teams. It's not that she's imposing, it's that she's prepared. If we all would come prepared, we would save a lot of time and get a lot further. But people took that in a different way, and so many people found it difficult to work on team with her.
I've been on both sides of that table, haven't you? At times annoyed that I'm three steps ahead of everyone else, and other times feeling incredibly inadequate because I'm at least three steps behind. In Portuguese, the native tongue of Brazil, they called Dorothy Eokipi. Loosely translated, she wasn't a team player.
But I always sincerely felt that was not a just accusation, because it's not that she wasn't willing to work together, it's that she just wanted to get a lot done in a short time. She wasn't going to mess around with, she wasn't going to dawdle. And like I say, she had this a vision that enabled her to put things together, and so she had a lot of irons in the fire and could tend to them. She dreamed big too, like that fruit factory, I remember.
One of the many projects Dorothy hatched to help the poor people of the Amazon help themselves.
That was started out as a cottage industry. And all of a sudden, she's got it on the kitchen table here and she's got a blueprint for this factory. And I'm saying, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, Dorothy, you'll never get that. That's way too big. The people won't be able to deal with that. It ain't going to work. Oh, but, this one's helping and that one's helping and we're going to, by gum, it's there.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
Fantastic for many, but for others, just too much. The fact is, Dorothy could ruffle feathers, particularly male feathers, in what was still a very macho society.
And here's this other paradox about Dot. She has these pretty blue eyes, this sweet smile, and she speaks very softly, but she is hard as nails. She's just sweet, but she's tough. She has droopy shoulders and humble eyes, but when you take her hand, it hurts. She gives a good grip. Her hand is big. It's big for a woman's hand and calloused. It's like a man's hand.
Sister Katie Webster agreed there was a dichotomy between Dorothy's demeanor and her bulldog tenacity.
She was a gentlewoman, she was a soft-spoken woman. But when she was trying to explain to you what it was that she wanted done in terms of the people getting their titles to the land, getting the financial assistance they need, I mean, you couldn't shut her up. You know, she wouldn't raise her voice, but you're not going to get a word in edgewise, so you might as well just listen.
Katie told a story about a brainstorming meeting she sat in with Dorothy and some of the Brazilian locals.
And I can't remember what the content of it was, but I can remember her asking me, well, don't you think this? And I said, no. And so then she presented another whole 10 minutes of arguments, and she says, well, don't you think so? And I said, no. And she took a breath, and I said, you asked me, what do I think? And I don't think what you're thinking. Well, the people, I mean, they just broke up laughing. It was sort of, it was healthy. You know, like, there could be a difference in an opinion.
Becky summed it up this way.
I remember an expression once, steel magnolias. That would be Dot.
Like all of us, Dorothy was yin and yang. But it was very important to Dorothy's friends that people grasp this about her, and to them, it was a critical distinction. Admittedly, Dorothy could be argumentative, but she was never adversarial. She really wanted to win people over, and never for personal gain, but always in the interest of the poor with whom she worked so tirelessly her whole life.
She would never bicker. She will not yell. That's not part of her. Raising her voice just doesn't go with Dorothy.
There were three things Dorothy went everywhere with in the 40-some years she spent in Brazil. Whether tucked in a satchel or a knapsack, she always had her Bible, a book of laws and property codes as they applied to the land the people fought over, and maps of the disputed areas. It's all she needed for any showdown.
You know, she'd be making her point and pull out her map and put her pencil down there, you know. She's a teacher to everyone.
Dorothy was able to get away with this. Various audiences put up with it, precisely because of her polite, gentle, motherly approach. And her gentleness wasn't just surface. In fact, it belied something much deeper that allowed her gentleness, even in the most stressful situations.
I mean, she really believed in the basic goodness of people. You know, she really believed in that. And I suppose in our heads we all do, but some part of us, not really. You know, some part of us holds back. Oh, yeah, everybody's basically good, but... No, Dorothy, everybody's basically good, so we're just going to reach in there and pull that goodness up to the top here, so where it can work.
It was this belief in the basic goodness of others, and eventually of all creation, that guided Dorothy on her journey. As the years went by, it led her deeper and deeper into the Amazon to fight for the rights of poor farmers and defend the disappearing rainforest against the terrorism of what some called the Green Mafia. Dorothy's unwavering belief in the basic goodness of everyone was steadfast, even on that fateful day in 2005 when confronted by her killers.
She would talk to anyone. She would forgive anyone. She just felt that everybody had a lot of good in them. And if you just were able to touch that, they would change.
You know, I mean, some people, when they go into battle evil, they concentrate on the evil. She battled evil, but she was spreading good, you know, and so her focus was somewhere else.
If belief in the basic goodness of God and humanity was the wellspring of her faith, what it nurtured was a passion for social justice. The seeds were planted back in Ohio by her mother and father, and nurtured in school by the Notre Dame de Namur nuns who taught her, and whose community she ended up joining when she was still a teenager. Considering Dorothy's personality, it was intuitively a very good match, especially when you consider the Notre Dame de Namur credo. Sister Bobby English, a contemporary of Dorothy's, recited their very simple mission statement for me.
To announce the goodness of God wherever we are, and to work with a special priority for the poor and the most abandoned places.
Those abandoned people and places, unfortunately, could be found everywhere. But from the beginning, Dorothy, like many of her fellow sisters, wanted to be a missionary in some far-off land. They all eventually got there, but not before beginning their careers a little closer to home, serving as school teachers in some of the poorest areas of the United States. Joan Krim.
On her application, when she entered, she had written at the top, I want to be a missionary in China. The year we entered, we were thrown out of China. And so that ended that as far as her going to China. She was eventually sent to Arizona.
Bobby English elaborated.
She ended up in Arizona, which was sort of like the Ohio province's mission territory. I ended up in North Carolina and Georgia, which in those days, it sounds so funny, but in those days, that was a mission. That was mission territory. I taught in a tiny little rural school. In those days, it was segregated, so they were all black children. They were very poor. They were beautiful, beautiful kids. I can remember every single one, first and last name, that I had. They were wonderful kids. They taught me how to teach.
While Bobby taught the children of sharecroppers in the American rural Southeast, Dorothy taught the children of migrant workers and Native Americans in the desert Southwest. Joan Krim.
But on the weekends and during the summer, she and some of the other sisters would go out to the Mexican migrant workers' camps. And it was there that she really began to get her drive against oppression of people. She would get vehement about it. And she wanted to do something. I think if she had stayed in Arizona, she would have been in all of the movements, the Cesar Chavez and all the other movements. It was her love of the poor and her love of God that just kind of drove her.
It would be another 10 years or so before any of these nuns were transferred to missions outside the U.S. And then certain events in history coincided to change all that. First, in the 1950s and 60s, Latin America became a key area of concern. Sister Bobby English.
At that time in the history of the church, there was an appeal for people to go to Latin America because of the so-called threat of communism. And so the church made an appeal to congregations of religious men and women to try to respond to that by sending their personnel to the missions to help shore up the local church.
Sister Jo Depweg, a strikingly beautiful nun, then and now, was one of the first to go.
Pope John XXIII asked that congregations in the first world should try to give 10% of their religious to help in the third world. And our congregation responded to that. And so in 1962, we sent 5 sisters to Brazil, and I was one of the 5. It was a great grace in my life that I was chosen to come.
It would be another 4 years before Bobby and Joan would be asked to go. So much time had elapsed since they first volunteered, they had almost forgotten about it. Bobby English.
I volunteered in 54, maybe, 50, something like that. And 12 years later, I'm in Georgia. I'm loving it. We're doing marvelous things. We have after-school programs going with the kids in the projects. And the bishop at that time is off the hook ecumenical, off the hook Vatican II. Just your ideal bishop. I'm loving it, every minute of it. And I get this letter, and it says, since you volunteer for the missions, we'd like you to go to Brazil. And I said, yeah, I guess I did.
Joan Krim, who had been teaching in Ohio, had the same mixed reaction when the call finally came for her.
In fact, when I wrote the letter and volunteered, I said in the letter that I was perfectly happy to stay here, that I loved teaching, I loved what I was doing. I even said I was no good at languages and that I didn't know how to drive a shift car.
And they took you anyway.
They took me anyway. Once I wrote the letter, I was at peace and actually forgot that I had written it. And 2 years later, I got this little blue letter from Rome saying, if things haven't changed, you will be going to Brazil in August of 66.
But that was not all.
In the meantime, Sister Dorothy had also volunteered, and I didn't know that. And she didn't know I had volunteered, so we ended up going down together.
So in 1966, the two childhood friends who had grown up together, smoked Catalpa cigars together, and entered the convent together, would now be heading off to Brazil together, along with their new friend, Sister Bobby English. For them and the other nuns who joined them there, it would be the beginning of a lifelong love affair with Brazil and her people. But as they headed south that day, they could have no idea just what lay ahead. They were young women, after all. None of them had been outside the U.S. before, much less anywhere as untamed as Brazil was at that time. They could have no way of knowing what challenges, triumphs, and tragedies were in store for them, no way of knowing the deep reservoirs of faith, willpower, and courage they would need to draw on along the way. But they had each other, and they had a mission.
I'm on my way, freedom land. I'm on my way, freedom land. I'm on my way, great God Almighty, I'm on my way. I asked my sister, won't you go with me? I asked my sister to go with me. I'm on my way, great God Almighty, I'm on my way.
You've been listening to Provoke, and part one of our story on modern-day saints and martyrs, as seen through the eyes of our producer, Claire Hartman. In part two, the exploration continues as we follow the nuns to Brazil, first to sunny Sao Paulo in the south, then to the poverty-stricken north, and eventually across the muddy Trans-Amazonian Highway and into the rainforest. The story is as much her fellow sister's story as it is Dorothy Stang's, but in the end, it was Dorothy who died a martyr's death. What was it besides her gentle demeanor and bulldog personality that led her to that moment? What other ingredients went into the making of this particular saint? Was she a product of her time, empowered by the support and love of her fellow sisters? Or was her fate determined by a series of personal choices that placed one in front of the other like the slats on the bridge to St. Raphael, led inevitably and irrevocably to her murder? And in those defining moments, towards the end of her life, when she had an almost prescient feeling about her impending doom, what gave her the courage to continue on? Tune in next week as the story continues. I'm Father Steve Spahn. To listen to this show again and all our shows, visit our website at provokeradio.com. That's provokeradio.com. If you want to contact us about anything, email us at producer@provokeradio.com or call us at 410-244-0446. Outside Maryland, dial 877-321-3215. Thanks for listening, and as always, blessed are the provoked. Provoke is sponsored by the Maryland Province Jesuits.